This is the seventh day of this seven-day November 1975 session. We will resume with another koan in the Mumon Kan. And this is case number 22, Kashapa and the Flagpole. The case reads, Ananda once said to Kashapa, "The world-honored one transmitted to you the brocade robe." "What else did he transmit to you?" Kashapa called out, "Ananda." Ananda answered, "Yes, sir." Kashapa called out again, "Ananda." "Yes, sir." Kashapa said, "Pull down the flagpole at the gate." Then we have Mumon's commentary. If you can give the exact turning word to this koan, you will see that the meeting at Mount Gridrakuta is definitely present here. If not, then know that Vipassana Buddha is still unable to get the truth, even though he began his seeking in remote antiquity. Then Mumon's verse. The calling out is good, but even better the answering. How many are there who have opened their true eyes? The elder brother calling, the younger brother replying. The family shame is revealed. This is a spring that does not belong to yin and yang. Could I have a copy of the chanting booklet, please? In trying to find some background material on the two protagonists of this koan, it is amazing that out of six books that were consulted by me, not one of them had more than a line or two about either Mahakashapa or Ananda. These were two of the great disciples of the Buddha. And it's interesting that no one has ever, of all the books that have been turned out on Buddhism about the Buddha, his life of the Buddha, no one has turned out a book, at least to my knowledge, about the disciples. What were their lives like? We get little clues about Ananda. As you know, in the Sharangama Sutra, really revolves around the fact that Ananda had gone to visit a courtesan, and little snatches here and there. But what sort of person was Ananda, really? What sort of person was Mahakashapa? We know that Mahakashapa, for example, was slightly older than the Buddha himself. He was the eldest of the disciples. And he was famous for the discipline of the 10 great disciples. Each of which had a special quality. For example, Shariputra with wisdom, Magda Guyana, supernatural powers, Mahakashapa, discipline, Anuruddha, Deva vision, Subhuti, explaining the void, Purna, expounding the law, Katyayana, fundamental principles, Upali, maintaining the rules, Rahula, who was the son of the Buddha, the esoteric teaching, and Ananda, hearing and remembering. We're reading here now from Blythe's book. And we're told here that Mahakashapa was a Brahmin, and that after the death of the Buddha, he convoked and directed the first synod, which decided upon how the order would be run and who would be the successor to the Buddha. As you noted here, Ananda was famous for hearing and remembering. He's said to have had a phenomenal memory, had a brilliant intellect. In fact, most, if not all, of the Mahayana sutras were said to have been, all of the sutras were said to have been remembered by him and passed on and then later copied out. He was said to have been a cousin of the Buddha. At the time of the Buddha's death, Ananda was about 43 years old. He'd come to the Buddha as a young man of 23. And for 20 years, he was the Buddha's personal attendant. There's no doubt you know many koans, the interlocutor is Ananda. He starts off by asking a question. This present koan, perhaps we should also add that in the convocation of that first synod after the Buddha's death, Ananda was not admitted. And even though he was one of the 10 great disciples, he was not admitted because he had not yet come to enlightenment. Mind you, 20 years as the Buddha's personal attendant, he still had not attained, of course, this is full enlightenment. We can imagine the mind state of Ananda. We can also imagine that, after the Buddha's death, then Mahakashyapa, by this first council, he was elected the leader of the community. And then Ananda was his disciple for almost 20 years before he finally came to full awakening. And this at a time when the Buddha himself was alive and his great disciple, Mahakashyapa, was also his teacher. And it is said that with this mundo, or this exchange, that Ananda came to awakening. This koan, of course, also deals with the subject of transmission. As you know, in the sixth koan, the Buddha holds a flower. There we have the transmission from the Buddha to Mahakashyapa. And here we have the transmission from Mahakashyapa to Ananda. In the patriarchal line, remember there is, first we have Vipassan Buddha, then we have Shikin Buddha, we have Vishabhu Buddha, Krakuchanda Buddha, Kanaka Muni Buddha, and we have Kashyapa Buddha. And this Kashyapa is not the same as Mahakashyapa. We have Kashyapa Buddha, then we have Shakyamuni Buddha. And with Shakyamuni Buddha, we have the first historical transmission. Then we have Mahakashyapa, and then Ananda. When we say we have the first historical transmission, this means that in our world cycle, the Buddha is Shakyamuni Buddha. And the other seven, seven of them are stated. Well, the Buddha is the seventh one. Shakyamuni Buddha is the seventh one. This is a way of indicating that there were other Buddhas before Shakyamuni, innumerable, unlimited in number, just as there have been world cycles beyond the measurement of time. And in Zen, this passing down this transmission of from teacher to disciple has been very much part of the Zen tradition. Now, what does this transmission amount to? First of all, we must remember that it is said in Buddhism, particularly in Zen Buddhism, that whenever a disciple attains to the mind of his teacher, transmission takes place. The outward indications are usually a robe and a bowl. That is to say, these are symbolic. But of course, it is the inner mind state. There's nothing tangible, of course, that's handed down. How can there be? So what is essential is that each one personally experience the truth to one degree or another and be able not only to and be able to testify to it in his own life. This constitutes the transmission. Strictly speaking, a master could have a number of Dharma heirs. And most of the masters have had a number of Dharma heirs. Usually the transmission, that is the strict transmission, is to one person, that is the teacher's senior most disciple, that is the one who is who not only is on a par with the teacher in terms of understanding, but who also, usually teachers will pass down to those who they feel the one person who, to carry on the line, will be the person who is capable, and there's much more than understanding which makes a person capable of being the head of a monastery or a center or whatever. We find throughout the history of Buddhism that very often, surprisingly, the person who becomes a direct heir may not be the one with the deepest understanding, even. For example, of the disciples of Nangaku, Chinese, Huaijiang, Shakujo, Baijiang, was the one who became the direct heir, although there were others among the disciples that were considered to be perhaps a little above him in terms of depth of understanding. But because Baijiang evidently was a fine administrator and had other qualities which fitted him for leadership, he was given specifically charged with directly carrying on the line. You may say that every Dharma heir carries on the line, but not quite in this formal sense. It goes without saying that anyone who has come to a deep understanding willy-nilly is teaching. No matter what he says or does, he's teaching. And in that sense, he can be said to be carrying on his teacher's lines. And you'll find in the Zen writings where some teachers would say, I think it was three disciples, three Dharma heirs, they would be happy. At a minimum, of course, one. And the significance of the three was, of course, one, if the first reason was that if the first one died, the second one was, I don't remember what the second reason was. At any rate, this transmission then is directly, you get in Zen, from mind to mind. So very often you have all kinds of formalities of the transmission through all kinds of ceremonies and rituals where a teacher will appoint his successor. At least in the early days of Buddhism, there was none of this kind of thing. The teacher designated his successor. Perhaps later on, as as Buddhism grew and developed, then the whole ceremony grew up around this, this passing on, the Dharma transmission. And also part of this, of course, means that there must be the verification of the teacher. The teacher verifies that the person has reached. That is, if one is a Dharma heir. Dharma successors and Dharma heirs, disciples. It's really a rather complex process, this whole thing. It's slowly become very weakened. In Japan today, it's become very confused and muddy. Nonetheless, this passing down, this transmission from mind to mind with the verification of the teacher, still is part of the Zen tradition. It is the verification of the teacher that is a kind of when the teacher puts a stamp of approval on a person. This is, in other words, saying to the public that I feel that this person is competent to teach my line. Of course, in the history of Zen, there have been teachers who have been, if the teacher himself is a highly evolved person with a strong character and a fine personality, then, of course, his stamp of approval has great value. If he isn't, and there have been many such teachers, then his stamp of approval means very little, really. Nevertheless, perhaps it's like a brand name, you might say. A very famous brand name, well, it has a certain guarantee, but in time, these things weaken, you know, and the brand name doesn't mean anything at all. And one reads Consumer's Digest or something like that and finds that a famous company are doing all horrible things to their product. And once the famous name no longer carries any real proof of anything, except that the product has been slightly despoiled, perhaps. So Ananda once said to Kashyapa, "The world honored one transmitted to you a brocade robe." What else did he transmit to you? The world honored one, of course, refers to the Buddha Shakyamuni. This appellation, the world honored one, is a very common Buddhist term. It is really the one universal Buddhist term, and what makes it so distinctive and beautiful is that it is uniquely Buddhist. That is to say, it does not borrow from Christianity or from any other great tradition. And one cannot mistake in the translation of it. It has to come out the world honored one if it's any kind of a translation. Terms like your reverence, or Lord Buddha, these still have a slightly Christian or perhaps un-Buddhist ring to them. The word Lord, which is a beautiful word certainly, but it has been used so extensively in other religions that it is much better to use a term like the world honored one. And world honored one doesn't mean that he is honored everywhere by people everywhere. It means the one who has realized the world in himself. This is what makes him honored. Throughout heaven and earth, I am the most honored one. Heaven and earth is the world. So the world honored one means just that, one who has swallowed up the whole world, who has become, well, we say become one with. This is really not a good expression at all. One for whom he is not his brother's keeper, he is his brother. transmitted to you the brocade robe. The brocade robe, sometimes, well, in the original, this is kesa, which is slightly different from robe. As you know, monks have robes, and then they wear over that what is called in Japanese the kesa. The kesa is this thing that goes over the shoulder. And this little thing that is worn by some of us here, which is called a raksu, means an abbreviated kesa. It says here the brocade. At the time of the Buddha, it was anything but brocade. It was a very simple robe, as you know, in Southeast Asia, there was no robe and kesa. There was just this wraparound robe, which really is, for simplicity, would be hard to beat. And it has its own distinctive quality and dignity. And it was made originally from castaway clothing as a sign of the poverty of the monks and the fact that they owned nothing. Just have one or perhaps an extra robe, which was just a piece of cloth that one wrapped around one. It would be hard to get a brocade. This putting in here a brocade robe comes from China and Japan, where the robes have become so brocade that it's just unbelievable to go to some kind of a ceremony involving big wigs, and it's like you're at a fashion show. This is certainly true in Japan today. And these robes have become so enormously expensive because they're made out of silk brocade. Silk was something that the Buddha explicitly condemned because it can only be got to the death of the silkworm. And so we must read this as when he transmitted to you the robe. Very sometimes this is put the robe and the bowl. These days, a robe and bowl are given to a disciple. It's an indication. This is what I received from my teacher. And but here, Ananda's asking, what else did he transmit to you? Now, obviously, Ananda, who's been with the monks there, in the community of monks for such a long time, he knew all about transmission. Why then would he ask such a question? We must put this question against the background of Ananda's many years of striving. We can see that for him the great problem was to get beyond his intellect, of the many words, his mind just must have been filled. Well, imagine all of these, remembering all of these suttas. When you think of the length of some of these suttas, the Lotus Sutta, the Sharangama Sutta, the Lankavatara Sutta, not to mention some of the lesser ones, you see what a tremendous thing it must have been for him to carry. How could he carry anything else in his mind? Or how could he get an empty mind? This is really more important. And he must have felt that somehow the secret to his awakening lay in that. Now remember, at this point, Kashyapa was his teacher. And this question, what else did he transmit to you? Was there some secret, perhaps, that he transmitted? Something that you would be willing to confide to me, to help me out? Some technique, some device. And this, we don't know at what point this happened. Well, this was probably many years after the convocation of the First Council. The significance of that is that it must have been a traumatic experience to Ananda to have been excluded from this council when all the other monks, perhaps many of them hadn't even served as long as he had served in the order, when they were admitted to the council and he was not. This must have been a tremendously painful and agonizing experience for him. And now he must have reached a point where, well, he was no longer memorizing sutras, presumably, because the Buddha was no longer giving them, and presumably he was not memorizing not sutras, but the words, the dialogues and the sermons and teisho of the Buddha. And so here we find him asking, what else did he transmit to you? Before we get further here, we should be some explanation about this pull down the flagpole at the gate. There are various interpretations or even translations of the original. Sometimes it's given as, well, the explanation, one explanation is given of the significance of this is that in the time of the Buddha at this time, that there would be there was going to be a sort of a dharma duel or two people were going to have a kind of a dharma dialogue, strictly speaking, that's what it would be. Very often this was held, they would put up two flags representing the two protagonists. Very often it would be, one of them would be a Buddhist and the other would be a non-Buddhist. And there was a sort of tacit understanding that whoever was judged by the audience to be the winner, and this was apparently evidenced by the amount of clapping that one person got, then a person, the loser, would pull down his flag and become a disciple of the other person. And so this is the the reference of pull down the flagpole. Now let us go on here. We've sort of got ahead of ourselves here. What else did he transmit to you? And Kashyapa called out, Ananda. He just said Ananda, but no doubt he implied a great deal more. What's the use of asking about what the Buddha transmitted to me? Realize your own mind. Pull down your own flagpole. Never mind about pulling down anybody else's. Pull down your own flagpole. What does this flagpole represent? What is the flagpole? What is the flagpole that every person has that needs to be horizontalized? Well, that could be one meaning in there. Or he could be implying something quite different. What else did he transmit to you? What is this mysterious thing I've heard so much about for 40 years? This thing that can't be named. This thing that existed before the world was even created. The thing that makes possible the rising of the sun, the shining of the moon, my walking, my crying, my laughing. What is this mind spirit? Well, the question is Kashyapa answering his question or isn't he? This is one of the points of this koan that you must look into and perceive the significance. First, of Kashyapa's calling out Ananda, and then Ananda's answering, yes, sir. Ananda may or may not have been the attendant of of Mahakashyapa, but it doesn't matter, of course. this was some kind of an exchange between them. And then Kashyapa repeats, Ananda. Very often this second Ananda and yes sir is omitted from this koan. How did that all she felt that this should be in there to make the koan really understandable? You need that second question, or that second Ananda and the answer, yes sir. Why do you suppose that would be necessary to the koan? What is the difference between the first calling and the first answering, and between the second calling and the second answering? We can say that in the second calling and answering, it was not only Kashyapa calling to Ananda and Ananda calling to him. Or was heaven calling to earth and earth calling to heaven? It was everybody in the world calling to each other. It was, my God, why hast thou deserted me? It was in that calling. All the pain, all the sorrow, all the joy, all the awe, all the mystery, were in this calling. And this calling, had there been a separation between them, there would just have been Kashyapa calling to Ananda, and Ananda calling to Kashyapa, answering Kashyapa. When they're absolutely one, then nothing is excluded. That moment, they both go back in time to timelessness. That moment of complete self-forgetfulness. We say self-identification, but even that has psychological implications. There was no more Ananda, no more Kashyapa, no more flagpole, no more world-honored one. Well, let me ask you, if all of that was transmitted, how was it transmitted? And what was it that enabled Ananda to come to awakening? As we all know, it is no easy thing to put down the flagpole of ego. Yet we see here, it does not necessarily mean slam banging and so on kind of thing. If one sees into the unreality of the ego, it sort of bends down itself because it has nothing to support it. Seeing into the reality of the ego is as though one were plucking the roots from the ego. And then when you take the roots of a plant or a tree, when they're plucked out, the tree necessarily falls or the plant necessarily dies. So there must be this sudden awareness, which can of course only come after long training of the mind. No longer a shorter time. Certainly full enlightenment takes a very long time. Then we have Mumon's commentary. If you can give the exact turning word to this koan, you will see that the meeting at Mount Gridvakuta is definitely present here. If not, then know that Vipassana Buddha is still unable to get the truth, even though he began his seeking in remote antiquity. As you know, Mount Gridvakuta, or Mount Vulture, this was a very famous peak where the Buddha gave many of his lectures, talks. You can give the exact turning word to this koan means if you can see into the workings of the minds of these two, and you'll know that the Buddha is still present and his teaching has become now not just an abstraction, but has become live in one's own experience. This is what it means to see face to face all the Buddhas of past, present, and future. In other words, to put it in another way, that experience of awakening transcends the body, the mind, time and space. Yet it must always work through time and space, through body and mind. In this sense, we can say that Zen is both historical and trans-historical at the same time. Just as what we realize can only work itself out through a body and a mind, in the same way, Buddhism can only have meaning through the personal experience of each one of us. The realization of true mind goes beyond our senses. It is not graspable with the senses. And yet, it is beyond, in its transcendental sense, it's beyond grasping and non-grasping. It can be known, it cannot be explained. It's another way, perhaps, to put it. No one says here, if you don't look into it, then know that Vipassana Buddha is still unable to get the truth, even though he began his seeking in remote antiquity. This is another way of saying that unless you come to awakening, no matter how hard you work, you will still never really understand the heart and soul of the Buddha's teaching. And here the Buddha's teaching can mean Buddha's S apostrophe, or it can mean A apostrophe S. One Buddha or many Buddhas teaching, doesn't matter. This Vipassana Buddha, this reference, apparently goes back to Zen Master Chao Cho, Joshu, famous Joshu, or who once he once said that Vipassana Buddha has kept on disciplining himself for an infinite length of time, yet he's unable to get the truth. Why? It's very much like the koan of number 9 in the Mumon koan about Daitsu Chisho Buddha. That's a Japanese, and this could refer to Vipassana Buddha. The universal Buddha mind, we can say. Now then we come to the verse. The calling out is good, but even better the answering. How would you understand that? Really, when there's true understanding, as we've said many times, the answer is in the question is in the answer. There can't be any better, any more better or less better. The calling out is good, and the answering is there. Or perhaps we can put it this way. When two minds are absolutely meat. And they know, they understand each other without having to say anything. That says, how many are those who have truly opened their eyes, or have opened their true eyes? Of course, this is talking about full enlightenment. Those who have really penetrated to the full truth are really, at all times, few. And this leads people sometimes to say, people who are on the fringes of any kind of a spiritual practice, well, if through the centuries so few people have come to enlightenment, why then should I, who don't have nearly their endowments, why should I, how can I hope to ever come to full enlightenment? And if I can't come to full enlightenment, why should I be satisfied with anything less than that? Why should I go through all the arduous training and so on? It's better that I live the way I am, and, well, I'll have my frustrations and my tough times and all of that, but it could be a lot worse if I tried to become a Buddha. Actually, one way or another, there are lots of people that think this way. And you see, it's a kind of a subtle rationalization of an unwillingness to do anything about themselves. If there were only one Buddha that we ever heard about, you know, out of history, this would be enough. This would be enough to reassure us that awakening, full awakening, and the great joy that it brings, and the completely transformed life that it leads to, brings about, is valid. It's valid for everyone. And valid for everyone means, in a sense that, you know, you find this in the sutras, that with one person's real, genuine enlightenment, even the grasses and the trees become enlightened. This is, to put it in a simpler kind of way, a less esoteric way, the Buddha's enlightenment is the guarantee that we can also become enlightened. And then the second question, well, why do we want to become enlightened? Why don't we want to become enlightened? That's a better question. Why shouldn't you want to become enlightened? You could never raise the question in any form unless there was this need for you to become awakened to your true nature. And this compassionate desire that every human being has to want to help oneself and help others, wants to, the compassionate desire to put our arms around the whole world, really, to love the whole world. This is a human, a natural human tendency, instinct, if you like, which is throttled by all manner of wrong living and thinking, feeling and acting. Brings about all of the pain. And so it's not a matter of becoming enlightened this week, this month, this year, 5 years, 10 years from now. As Dogen says, there's no beginning to enlightenment and end to practice. There's no beginning to practice and end to enlightenment. To return to our original purity and wholeness, we are born only to do that, really. And when we say born only to do that, that doesn't mean in just one lifetime. Lifetime after lifetime. To return to our original wholeness from which we have been separated by our discriminating intellects. Well, that sounds pretty tame when you say original wholeness. The separation that causes so much antagonism and war and violence and struggle and pain, all of this is the outcome of this separation, this division, which later becomes alienation. So anyone who truly, in whom the need to return to this original unity, has risen, can no longer ask that question. It is only somebody who's on the outside who can ask that question. And of course, every why question can only be made from an external point of view. When you are one with whatever it is, you can't stand outside of it and ask why. Standing out, the asking why is an indication that you are outside. And you'll never get inside as long as you're asking that why. Once you drop that sort of thing, then your chances for getting into the center, into the warm periphery of things, of life, is assured. Now this thing, the elder brother calling out, the younger brother replying, the family shame revealed. Where is the family shame here? What family is this referring to? The elder brother obviously refers to Mahakashyapa. The younger brother is Ananda. In what sense can we speak of there being some shame in this calling? And if so, is it in the first calling or is it in the second calling? This is another one of the barriers in this verse. It says, this is a spring that does not belong to yin and yang. As you know, yin and yang refers to the positive and negative. There are many meanings of yin and yang, but everything comes into being through yin and yang. This is a spring that does not belong to yin and yang. And also according to yin and yang, the seasons follow each other. Spring is followed by summer, summer is followed by autumn, autumn is followed by winter. We can say that this progression is due to yin and yang. Now, this is a spring that does not belong to yin and yang. What does that mean? This spring is somehow different. Remember what spring stands for. It stands for freshness, for renewal, even resurrection. We can see that Ananda's enlightenment certainly falls into this category. Suddenly, spring is spring. The yin and yang of spring is spring is spring. When spring is spring, and yet is spring, this is a different kind of spring. Literally, spring means jumping, jumping for joy. It means jumping because you're no longer tied down. You're no longer frustrated. You're able to spring out to respond spontaneously to things, your emotions, everything. Are warmly one with everything, not apart. Now let us say something about the Sesshin. Usually, the last night of a Sesshin, people are told, you are now free to work in any way that you want to. Actually, it seems that this was said, one way or another. People, most of you were told that you can go out anywhere you want to go, work in any way you wish. And working in any way you wish means specifically that if you find that going back to the original koan of Mu, for example, when this monk came to Joshua and said, "Is it true that even a dog has the Buddha nature?" In other words, even such a lowly thing as a dog. Evidently, in ancient China, the dog was considered to be a very low animal for some reason. How can it be that if a human being, such an exalted thing as a human being, has this wonderful, exalted, lofty thing called Buddha nature, that even a dog could have it? Well, this is the implications of his question. There may have been other implications. And Joshua answers, "Moo," which normally would mean no or not or has not. So in effect, he's saying, a dog does not have the Buddha nature. This seems to be contravening the sutras, which say that all living beings, the Nirvana Sutra says, all living beings have this Buddha nature. What did Joshua mean? Obviously, this is not an ordinary no that stands against yes. And if going back to the koan in that way can rouse a doubt sensation in people who find it very difficult to rouse a doubt sensation simply by asking what is mu, certainly that is perfectly legitimate. It's more legitimate, more than legitimate. It's highly desirable. You can get a real bite to the question, so you really want to know, why did Joshua say, what is mu, what is the significance of his mu? Then this puts it squarely in the realm of a koan. What then is this Buddha nature? On one hand, the Buddha says we have it. On the other hand, Joshua says we haven't had it. We don't have it. A dog doesn't have it, rather. Masters don't lie. It's inconceivable that he could be mistaken and made a slip of the tongue. What then does this mean, this mu? Well, as you heard a moment ago, this is another way of working on mu. Again, as you have heard, you heard this morning, the days of a sesshin do not disappear. They become larger and larger. As the succeeding days go on, each day packs all of the preceding days so that the seventh day of the sesshin is the most powerful of all. How then can anyone even think of the end of the sesshin? Be like somebody who was digging for gold. Let's say, after a long time of digging for it, suddenly hits into a vein and suddenly decides that, well, I don't want this after all. It's time to, I've got to go back. I've got to go back to wherever you came from, wherever it is. Let's forget all about this thing. It was a lot of fun, but I don't want this gold anyway. Trouble with, of course, giving this kind of analogy to Zen people is that they're not very material, they're not materialistically minded, so gold. It's the trouble with all of these metaphorical expressions that They just don't ring a bell for modern modern people. Somehow one has to get some new metaphors and analogies which will ring some kind of a bell. Well, the best that I can think of is gold right now. Although personally I wouldn't know what to do with it either if I was really, I can't think of anything worse than if we discovered gold and honey oil or gas or oil. It would just be the end of all of us, really. At any rate, this last day is important. after all is said and done. And there are a number of people who are really not that far to go. And these extra hours can't be emphasized too strongly, really, how important these extra hours are. One takes the attitude that the session is almost over. I wish it would go on. I'm just now beginning to get into my practice, and this is true with many people. If you have this kind of feeling about it, then the session will go on. It will not be too short for you. And certainly will not be too long for you. You must keep on going. We'll stop here and recite the following.